Welcome to a History of Horror podcast, a year-long journey through films throughout the decades, examining across the globe what makes us scared. Christopher Brown. So, where are we now? And when I say now, what I mean is where are we in terms of horror in Europe and the US? This part of our story is very much about in terms of where we are, maybe not where other parts of the world are. On September 5th, 1995, ESPN SportsZone streamed a live radio broadcast of a baseball game between the Seattle Mariners and the New York Yankees to thousands of its subscribers. At the time, it was using a Seattle startup called Progressive Networks. That became real-time and then real-time player, and they got embroiled in one of the many internet bubbles and fights and battles of in the late 90s, early noughties. That streaming has expanded, obviously, away from just radio to something we probably take for granted now, considering the fact that, you know, though this isn't live streamed to your ears, you know, many people can live stream video from the computer games they're playing, and you know, you're downloading audio. I've recorded and uploaded, and if I wanted to live stream, I could do it. Could, you know, click a few buttons, turn it on, or you could, and that's moved on to because of a few big changes, greater bandwidth, especially in the last mile from cable, and a move away from copper wire on internet and phone lines. The fact that we have access now to the internet in a far greater way. I remember, having mates in 2005 with 8 megabyte broadband that they'd all pitched in for, and I just feel thinking it was the quickest thing in the world. Standardization of protocols as well, which is the upshot of that one of those real things there, real media players that finally, like, you know, it kind of all settled down in terms of who owns what and who does what. And the internet's become commercialized, and people have used it as a way to disseminate information, but also a way to earn money. And I've kind of grasped onto this concept of being able to stream content to providers at any point, at any time, day or night. So this idea of streaming info and content isn't anything new. You know, we had that live sporting event in 1985, but Severe Tire Damage, which is a rock band, played live on the internet in 1993. So you can probably guess where this conversation's going, really. Now we've got everything from streaming, you know, if you're in UK, you can get Sky streaming live TV or Virgin. If you're if you're in America, you've got HBO and all those different types of services, Hulu, Netflix and Amazon competing for your attention and your hard-earned cash, amongst many other different providers and services offering different things. And, you know, at its core, as well as these subscription services, we've got iTunes, which is a far more like a video shoppy kind of element, in the fact that you go online and you see all the videos you want and you can rent them or buy them. There's generally a feeling that streaming content and online content killed physical media. And I'm not sure how true that is in the end. I think generally the ability to get as much stuff as possible has kind of reduce the need for them. I mean, why would you go down the street and you're not sure it's the film you want to watch is even there when you can just pick it up for the same price online or through your cable provider to rent, or indeed to stream illegally as well. And that's, you know, I think for it's the journey of the 80s and 90s and the noughties in terms of how that went is, I think for fans of certain, like, you know, home video cultures, not the greatest anyway, because, you know, you had what Americans call mom and pop stores over here, you know, like family local shops selling video, you know, kind of thing you get on it, or rent, you know, having video to hire, I should say. They got took over basically by Blockbuster. I mean, the big money kind of came in, and with wider choice and variety and more of the latest films, we have to push out the competition. So it doesn't seem quite so bad that now a lot of people have moved on to digital formats. They were able to, you know, they shut down, you know, Blockbuster, for example.
Kenning, don't even think about coming home without that new video.
Somehow, Saturday was always a bad day for Kenning.
Yeah, good film, nice length, good colour, good quality, good production. Really enjoyed it. Yeah, haven't got it. It's out.
Until...
Hi, man, we're the Blockbuster Entertainment team.
Meet Benny, Sandy, Bob, and Kate. They're the Blockbuster Entertainment team, and they buy more copies of the films you want than anyone.
I want 25,000 copies next month.
So people like Kevin can have a life like Kevin.
The Blockbuster.
Blockbuster Video, the entertainment team.
I think for me and particularly the subscription service kind of stuff, it's a bit different with iTunes, because there is a lot on there. But subscription stuff does kind of generate the illusion of choice. In the US, there's a lot more variety than there is over here. And the thing about a video shop for me was that content was curated. It was, you know, there was the new releases and then some classics. And there was a lot of them. So you kind of knew where you were. And, you know, those films have been picked specifically for that audience. And, you know, a video shop owner wouldn't have gone out of his way to find something that he didn't think was interesting or unless he thought, you know, he could shift it. So you kind of got something that kind of, you know, attached to the community. Something like Netflix in the UK feels like a collection of films. Some 80s, some 90s, some modern day. What it doesn't feel like is a curated content. In the UK, there's kind of jokes about in terms of, you know, if you like this, you'll like, you know, another film. But because the content is so sparse, that you never kind of get, you know, it never suggests something that you'd want or is like even related to that film. And then, you know, you might have Saw 6 or 5 available, but not Saw 1 or 2. The US's choice is a lot broader, and I know you can use proxies to kind of get data content over here as well. But I think as time goes on, we'll find that increasingly more difficult as copyright infringement becomes more of a problem for companies like Netflix. And they are going to start clamping down on that. There's also no advice. There's no, like, you know, these recommendations are based on algorithms, and, you know, if you've got two, you know, and if your profile isn't particularly, you know, could be quite random because you might use it a lot, and therefore you might use lots of different stuff. It could throw up all sorts of stuff, and it might not, and because of that, it kind of closes off certain areas of the site to you, so you may only see those kind of creepy B movies that you had a splurge of one wet afternoon a few weeks ago, rather than some of maybe some foreign content that you'd be interested in but just didn't know was there. And for me, the biggest shame in all this is the salesmanship in terms of going to a video shop, having a guy behind the counter who's trying to, you know, shift as many videos as he can because it's part of his job, and like, you know, recommendations, understanding, and that kind of guided information. I think it's interesting, you know, if you've got something like Sky Movies and you've got all those films, which, you know, we do have, the temptation just to kind of flick onto the Sky channels and just see whatever's on anyway is huge. And I think that's part of the reason that a lot of the time, if you've got 500 to choose from and you're not even sure what a lot of these films are, you might just have a picture and a poster to kind of go on as your eye scanners down. It's not ideal, I would say. This on-demand market online has kind of created a small flurry of films that have been kind of purposely designed for that market. VHS movies and the ABCs of Death are the two that really stick in the mind of anthology films using lots of different directors, low budgets, and kind of big, bulky kind of movies. So they get the model is different to a traditional model, because what we've got is a more expensive release on iTunes initially, and like those kind of pay on demand services before moving on to streaming services such as Netflix, and you know, on demand and that kind of stuff. When it works, it's really good. With like this, something like VHS, content like VHS Viral, the third film in that series, has not been successful. And one of the reasons for that is that it wasn't, you know, it wasn't as popular, so it didn't kind of generate the buzz and the fuss it needed. And then when it was released, it kind of, you know, took 6 months or more to get released in the UK. By that time, any interest on it had gone, and anyone who wanted to watch it either acquired a copy from the US or was streaming it illegally. So that kind of killed that. I think illegal streaming generally can be a big problem for horror, because it's the kind of thing that people might maybe willing to take a punt on. Eli Roth blames Hostel 2's lack of success on online streaming. I think there's a frustration, particularly with what's been going on with Eli Roth's work, with, let's say, for example, The Green Inferno, which took so long to get out that when it did, I think people just jumped on it and pounced on it. And so they weren't able to do staggered international releases as well as they'd probably hoped. And yeah, so you've got a hardcore fans who are desperate to see it, and the only way they can see it is through BitTorrents. So that's what they did.
Have you ever had fantasies of saving a dying tribe?
Out of the campus as a student!
My father's a lawyer at the UN. Maybe he could get involved somehow.
We can't just go invade a country because they're doing something that we think is illegal or immoral anymore.
Staging a rally.
It's a school trip, Dad. I'll be fine.
Honey, it's a dangerous place.
The villagers are here, here, and here.
They have guns?
They're gonna shoot you and bury the bodies.
You're not ready for this.
I am. Let me prove it.
Now, this death of a video shop, as it is now, indicates a death of physical media. But I don't think it's true. Certainly not for horror buffs, anyway. I think, you know, one of the reasons for that is the growth of Blu-ray in specialist markets. From companies like Arrow and 88 Films, in the UK, and then Vinegar Syndrome or Synapse in the US that put out decent prints of B-movies, obscure movies, trash, and really kind of give a new look on them. I think 88 Films has just released a version of Burial Ground. They did Zombie Holocaust last year. And they're interesting choices because they're trashy. I mean, they are trashy. Zombie Holocaust in the US is known as Dr. Butcher MD. The MD standing for Medical Deviant. And, you know, it's a real hotspot of Italian themes and ideas and thrown into the mix. I think the interesting thing about that is that, you know, to give that a loving kind of release, you know, scratchy prints as the Burial Ground release has got, is fascinating to see. And it kind of really kind of shows that there is a market still for people who want this physical media. Also because, you know, you're not picking up films like Burial Ground on streaming. They're not designed for that kind of, you know, a company like 88 Films could release 200 or 300 copies of film in the UK and kind of turn a slender profit as part of a wider portfolio of films. But in terms of, you know, streaming cinema, there's little interest in that. So you don't get something like Burial Ground or Nightmare City available to stream on your Netflix account. You have to look elsewhere. There's but you know, but the other side of this is that we've got companies like, you know, there are dedicated streaming services, like The Horror Show in the UK, which provides a place for more B-movies and like direct-to-video releases, which is great because they're all centralised at one point for a very particular audience. And there is some subscription elements to it as well. For me, what's more interesting, and I know it's not likely to be the reason why people are using these kind of services, is channels like The Horror Channel or Chiller. And I would have killed for a channel like that when I was growing up, you know. I think, you know, the best I got was when I was in my early 20s was Film 4, which we had to pay for at that point. But the Horror Channel has this collection of, you know, it can be everything from quite tame horror fare through to, you know, video nasties, things like The Beyond and that kind of stuff, and far more the extreme side of stuff. And you know, and that's free to air in the UK, which is just wonderful. I think underappreciated for what it's doing to kind of bring horror back into the mainstream in the UK. And again, you know, cable channel Chiller in the US does a similar job. For me, one of the biggest changes in the way all this works, and one of the reasons why I think this is happening, is that films are kind of in this like maelstrom of streaming. It's very difficult to stand out. So, you know, there's far more effort to push things into the mainstream. So what we've got is, you know, what Bret Easton Ellis coined art house horror, which I don't think is a particularly great phrase. He just means good. But these are films that have kind of broken onto cinemas. They may be independent films like Goodnight Mommy or It Follows or The Babadook. And they are films that basically follow proper, aren't necessarily just B-movies, but they may actually follow themes and have different ideas to them and be created in a way that really kind of, you know, they're well-made, well-crafted movies. And they now have a different model has been created for these films that kind of make them stand out and kind of, so in the US, they deliberately kind of, with It Follows, they deliberately held back video on demand or, and like Blu-ray service, rather than going all three at once, theatrical, at VOD and Blu-ray, they kind of did a more almost kind of traditional theatrical run first, which is interesting itself because, you know, and that was kind of held up as being quite brave, you know. because what it meant was that the... a film like Goodnight Mommy was filmed on... the exterior shots are filmed on 35mm, which kind of gives it an indicator of being, you know, a bit nicer. It's a well-shot, well-crafted movie. At its heart, though, it's a B, and it's got a really obvious twist. So I think for some horror fans, it's kind of been a bit divisive. Probably, in truth, because it was far better sold in the trailers than as one thing. And then the film itself is a bit like you're kind of waiting for the thing to happen that happens. The Babadook, it was, is again a very well-crafted movie and talks about family and about grief in family and how that can tear families apart. And as such is a far, you know, is a lot better than a Monster in the Basement film, which is what it alludes to. But recently The Witch, which came out in the last few weeks in the UK, has some strange kind of, it's a family drama, but it's a horror film as well. And, you know, there's themes in terms of fear in women, and it's all of it's based, it's kind of set in this like 17th century in New England, and it's based on reports and ideas about what was happening at that time. And, you know, obviously this idea that people are, would blame witchcraft or sorcery on their misfortunes. But at the same time, you know, it is a horror film and does have these elements that, you know, is there a monster in the woods or not? And I won't ruin it by kind of, you know, going into what is going on. But it does have those kind of, at its tensest, it's a film about family friction, I would say, rather than about, you know, goats and if they're talking to children or not. Although that's a key driver in the in generating the horror.
Black Philip Sif, you are wicked.
Cut Philip. Does he really speak to thee?
Cut Philip.
This wilderness will not consume us.
Cut Philip.
Who's there?
Cut Philip.
You've cursed this family.
Cut Philip.
This is witchcraft.
She placed a curse on me.
Why have you turned against me?
Swords.
Your rake of evil. It's not safe. Not with them.
The girl I sense.
What I find surprising, probably more so with The Witch than most films, is that they are getting bigger releases and the push is to kind of put them in a traditional kind of sense. Krampus Over Christmas was a successful horror movie. It was a PG-13, which kind of helps its corner in the US, but it did very well. And it did very well, I think, because of its traditional kind of release and the fact that people still see that kind of journey is important. When we talked about the 90s and the 80s, the story kind of fragments a bit for the US and the UK because the video market is so broad and there's not a clear cut path in terms of what's popular or not. Things just kind of get released. And I think that's interesting because it does kind of give that indication of where people's minds still are, that, you know, what is a traditional film? What is a successful film? And I think box office figures do add to that. And if you want your release to maintain popularity through the years, to be seen as a proper movie that will, you know, be on TV a lot and that kind of thing, that will be seen as a modern classic, I think you do need that theatrical run at the moment, and probably more so now than you did in the 80s, for example, where films could become, you know, could bomb at the cinema and then do better on VHS. So what does this mean for horror? It means that we are, in the same way with the internet, we are surrounded by a choice, and sometimes an illusion of choice too. You kind of get fed up the same 100 films, possibly in different places, in different ways. You're reliant on a small number of Blu-ray and VHS providers to offer a film up in the best format possible. You have fans that go online and debate the minutiae of whether the print's good enough quality or not. None of that really helps the situation there, in terms of what's a good film and what and why, and those kind of personal moments. I find it surprising that a film like The Church and The Sect, Michel Savary's films, are only just getting a proper Blu-ray release in the UK now, considering the fact that in the 80s there were Stone Cold classics. But I suppose it's trend-based. But if you're reliant on Arrow and 88 and Shameless to kind of release these films in the UK, and they're maybe reliant on other companies doing new prints of the films and then selling on that print to foreign markets. On the plus side, we're having a mini revival of horror in the UK, I'd say. The fact that, I mean, the internet again clouds this, because a film could be released in the US on Blu-ray for, you know, 6 months, for example, or for a couple of months at least, in the occasion of Bone Tomahawk and Goodnight Mommy, which were released basically within a week of each other, over here this month. And if you wanted to, you could quite easily go online and get those films already. The Green Inferno got released a lot later than the US, and that was okay in the days when there wasn't the ability to go out there and find those films. But you know, I think if all you need to do is kind of look at what people on Twitter and some podcasters and bloggers were talking about when Green Inferno was released in the US, and a lot of UK people must you know, either got it on import or got it on Pirate Bay, and suddenly that kind of you know, it's less likely to hit the kind of numbers it needs to get a theatrical release. And I think that's where we are with a lot of this stuff. I think this is a little kind of, you know, flurry of activity for horror films. Because of It Follows success last year, it's obviously been penciled as a good time to release these kind of films, aside from the usual, you know, October market. And so people, that's what's happened. How long that will last, considering the fact that we've had like a horror film a week for the last month, I don't know. And I don't know what it'll be like next year. I suppose it all depends on what we've got coming up in the future.
I used to daydream about being old enough to go on dates. I had this image of myself holding hands with a really cute guy. Just having some sort of freedom, I guess.
Jay, I'm sorry.
Oh. You're not gonna believe me, and I need you to remember what I'm saying. This thing. No! It's gonna follow you. Somebody gave it to me, and I passed it to you.
Wherever you are, it's somewhere walking straight for you. All you can do is pass it along to someone else.
What exactly is supposed to be following you?
I don't know.
Just pass it along.
You believe me, right?
Nothing's gonna happen.
See? Everything's okay.
There's something wrong with me.
If it kills her, it goes straight down the line whoever started it.
Gonna be here sooner or later.
Speaking of the future, that is the episode for our last episode for next time, where we kind of just wrap everything up, kind of say how we see it, and then finish it off. If you want to get hold of me, please do. Probably more so this time than most. Just if you've enjoyed the run, drop us an email or some audio feedback at historyofhorror@gmail.com. You can go to the website at historyofhorror.com, or you can get me on Twitter at @orange_monkey. So until the end, and we talk about the future, and we say our goodbyes, take care, and I'll speak to you soon. Goodbye.